welcome back to the last part of Flippity Flappity, the all-encompassing roundtable discussion programme that tries to expose and solve all the problems of the world, but only seems to make them worse and more punchable. Round our table, still, despite numerous attempts to kill him with a rake, is Simon Marrowface, leader of the loud right-wing belligerent Jowley Party.
Bloody immigrants!
Next to him, it's Jeff On The Fence, founder of the I Don't Rightly Know Coalition of Indecisive Greengrocers, and who has just recently released a new album all about root vegetables.
I'm not so sure I like this, but I'm still very happy to be here.
Next to him is Fenella Limp. She's trying to still be a Christian, knits massive unwearable purple hats for the homeless, votes liberal but is still unsure about global warming.
When do we get cake?
Next to her is Marjorie Vehement, who is so chest-thumpingly left-wing it even makes some liberals vomit and therefore can't possibly do anything but enrage everybody. She's also Minister for Sock Drawers and leader of the Why Bugs Bunny Is Not a Good Role Model for Blind Gay Librarians Club.
I object to your use of the word vomit on the grounds that it discriminates against those who may, through no fault of their own, not have stomachs.
Lastly, wedged between me and her is vacuous celebrity and part-time hair annoyance Gabriel Thigh.
My new movie's in theatres now!
So, collected panel, your views on the referendum for Britain to leave Europe?
I'm quite what? Well,
we're not all about the
bloody immigrants, England! The Queen. Well, I think we've all learned a very vital lesson there about global politics. Next week, I'll be talking to the Archduke Peregrine, owner of all the hams, about his tendency to dip his gangly parts into troughs of suet pudding. And we'll have a roundtable discussion on the viability of a Donald Trump presidency with two otters, a sedated bear, three goats, and the Minister for the Interior, Nigel Babancock. Good night. Listening to Radio Flange Goblet, and now the return of the aftermovie Diner, which this week features three gratuitous uses of the word botty. And during a portion of the show, I believe you can hear one of the patrons of the diner doing indecent things with a cup of fat.
So it's a new diner for us, a place we've never been here before.
We have not been here before.
Us being here has never...
ever happened.
So we've got lunch menus.
We've got today's dinner menu, today's lunch menu, separate things going on here. Very exciting. I like the... it's got green and white tablecloth, gingham style, which I quite enjoy. they've got the specialty sandwiches, which I know you're a fan of.
They haven't got a Hudson.
They've got a Hudson special salad.
Oh, yeah. No, they're just salads.
It says Hudson.
Yes, but you've got to have Hudson in the name.
I have my rules, you know this.
Well, they have a West Village Chicken Delight.
Do they? Where's that?
They're on there.
Cozy style chicken.
They do a French dip. I might have
chicken,
a French
Smith's
dip.
Rye bread, tomato, bacon, fried onion.
Have you ever had a French dip?
It sounds obscene.
It does sound a bit obscene. Like, sound like something you had in your wayward youth.
Yeah, well, not my wayward youth, obviously. Somebody else's wayward
youth. Somebody else's wayward
youth. Not our wayward youth.
Jeff's there's one. It's a Hudson sandwich.
There we go.
Grilled Swiss cheese.
Ooh.
Fresh cut turkey on rye bread.
Sounds nice.
Well, it's just a Swiss and turkey. It's not terribly imaginative, is it?
No.
It's just a Swiss and turkey sandwich.
True.
Turkey and Swiss.
Oh, yeah, but it's got... It's on bread.
Yeah, I know. Thank you very much. I think I'm going to get the West... Maybe I'll get the West Village.
Maybe. That's as close to a special. What have we got on dinner specials?
I've never seen anybody. That was a very old man where I'm looking at the window. You had to like, hold it a distance enough away for you to be able to read it.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Homemade spinach pie. Going to give me more information than homemade spinach pie. That's it.
What information do you want?
What, is this a spinach in a pie?
Yeah.
But that would be awful. Is there anything else, like potatoes, sauce?
No.
So it's a spinach.
I would imagine a little bit of cream.
It's just spinach in a pie.
Look, I didn't write the damn thing. Or make.
Well, you should have done.
I think I'm going to have the French dip. Because the French dip is on garlic bread. And I've always loved
garlic bread.
Garlic bread.
Where's garlic bread? Let me see.
It's French dip, roast beef with natural gravy. I don't want natural gravy.
Could I have it with unnatural gravy, please?
Is that bum gravy?
Don't. Why do you have to go to bums? Unnatural could be anything.
No, no, but it's.
In fact, there's nothing more natural
what's
than your bum.
Gravy? True.
Unnatural
but it's
would be like,
natural
I am your gravy. Call me on your sandwich. You go, oh, I don't think so.
Robot gravy on garlic bread.
Like unnatural gravy to me.
On garlic bread.
I am natural, I assure
you.
You
missed my point.
Oh, it is garlic bread.
How can gravy be natural? I suppose because it's the drippings of the meat.
Excuse me, could you bring me to today's garlic bread? I'd like to take a look at him.
I'm quite enjoying this diner already. It's nice and quiet. Good,
yep,
good sound
true.
Quality. They've got some horrible music.
That's
nice
true.
Tablecloths.
That's true. I know. I kind of want to get that medicine, but it looks fucking boring. It's today.
Jim is distraught that there's no more details about the spinach pie.
I imagine nobody needs it. Look, distraught is strong.
No, no. There was a level of distraughtness in you that I haven't seen.
No, actually. To be fair,
I think since August 1987, when you were particularly distraught.
When I was 10.
Yeah.
When you were 10. I guess I would have known you back then.
Yeah. Yeah, you would have known me, so don't pretend like you wouldn't have done.
Well, I pretend now.
Well, I know you pretend
like,
now.
But only at certain moments, like when other people see us together.
Like when I'm walking down the street filming you.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, I'm not with him, he just won't leave me alone.
I don't know who that is.
He just keeps filming my face.
Attack of the Curious Geography Teacher.
So I think I'm going to have the French dip, but...
Open steak, corned beef and pastrami. Yeah,
please read out the instructions of... The instructions? Ingredients.
Eat the food.
Read out the instructions of the sandwich. So yes, we're here in the Hudson Diner, which is on Hudson and Barrow in the West Village. It's a fairly swanky part of the village, I would say. A fairly quiet part of the village. The diner is famous because I believe it appeared.
I'm going to
West
Village.
Well, I say famous. It appeared in an episode of Louis.
Oh, did it?
The diner did, yes.
Cool. I can see why.
Well, I think he also lived it here because it's not far from the comedy club in the opening titles, I think. So we had a lovely, nice walk down from Midtown down to the village.
Yeah,
and then we went to the Film Forum. Which contains more hair grease and sour-looking faces than a Chris Isaac concert.
The bloke that looks like the Iranian goalkeeper that just got banned for wearing SpongeBob SquarePants trousers.
Right.
He was the guy that took our tickets.
He was the guy who took our ticket. Well, the
and
incredibly
he seemed really happy.
Flamboyantly blonde quiffed gentleman.
He seemed very
there
happy.
Were plenty of other people who were moping around looking like they'd just
He was quite mopey. The guy that gave us our tickets was particularly mopey.
He was. Everyone was mopey.
One check.
I'm not wriggling out of anything. You paid for the tickets, I'm paying for the dinner.
Can I get the West Village?
West Village.
And a cup of chamomile tea. Cup of chamomile tea.
Okay.
Lovely, thank you very much.
And I'm just going to have a French dip, please.
Can you agree?
I'm going with water. Thank you
very much.
It
sounds like really immature, but had this been like a Bernie Hill sketch where we go, yes, and I'd like a French dip, please. And I was expecting him to slap you.
Why would that be a Bernie Hill sketch? You're the bald one. You're the one who.
What's that guy doing with anything?
Because he used to smack the little bald guy.
Oh, I don't know that much about it. I guess I was more just like, you know, double entendre sketch shows.
Oh, right.
From the 70s. Why would I like a French dip, please?
True. You know.
Anyway, yes, he was very grumpy the moment.
I'll bring you the lemon water for you to dunk your balls in it.
In what world does that sentence make sense except in the obscene way? Are you writing like postmodern sketch show
where
everybody just says obscene things but in like normal company?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
No, but the film forum is, you know, for a start, it's a cinema in New York City that is cash only. Immediately, someone needs to be smacked around the face for that.
Well, hang on, isn't... what's the one that we've been to lots of stuff at?
The Archives?
Yeah, the Archives, that's nope. cash only.
No.
Nope. No, that's cards?
They take cards.
Oh. Then, yeah, that's pretty... It's just annoying. Right. I wouldn't say it's pretentious.
Not only that, but they're running a series at the moment, and they're actually screening, like, some fairly exploitative stuff, which I'm quite a fan of. Well, not exploitative, but, like, genre
stuff. He's exploitative,
stuff.
Specifically. He likes exploitation.
No, meaning...
He likes exploiting.
Meaning, like, they're showing... At the moment, they're having a series of movies directed by women that are considered genre films, And the name of the festival, instead of being called, I don't know, Girl
Wait
Power
for it.
Or something.
Wait,
the
Girl Power. That's where you would go with.
No, I wouldn't go.
Thank you very much.
That's probably a mistake. No, instead of it being called, I don't know,
Girl Power?
Kick-Ass Women or something.
Again, so I think they did fine.
They called it the genre is this genre is woman or something like that.
The genre is woman.
Yeah, which is pretentious.
I know it's pretentious, but it's also better than Girl Power.
Or Kick-Ass Women.
Or Kick-Ass Women. So if you can come up with a better one, I'm all ears.
All right.
So far,
but this
we've
podcast,
had Girl Power.
This podcast is not called John Comes Up With Better Names for Female-Centric Exploitation Genre Movie Festival.
Yeah, fair point. We've slagged off movies, and neither of us have made better movies than the movies we've slagged off.
Right.
Fair point.
I'm just checking with where we are, still recording. We're still getting this gold.
I am sorry.
So anyway, there's a festival of genre films directed by women, which it's kind of right up my street in a way. They're showing American Psycho, which is Mary Harron, I believe, and they're showing Slumber Party Massacre, which was produced by Roger Corman's wife, but was directed by a woman who, despite it being a fairly generic slasher, was trying to satirize the whole like women in bikinis being chased by a guy with a big phallic weapon kind of thing, because in Slumber Party Massacre he has a big drill, so that's like the whole... Anyway, they're showing that, which is kind of unusual because that doesn't get screened very often, certainly not stuff like Film Forum, where they normally show black and white stuff and things with subtitles and things where people can sit around and grease their hair and look very serious and stroke their beards.
Well, that's why Mr. Yellow Trousers is probably happy.
Right.
Is what we were going to say.
But they're also showing more or less like Kathryn Bigelow's entire back catalogue up until the Hurt Locker, right? Because they're showing Near Dark. They're showing
Strange Days. They're not saying Strange
Days. Yeah,
they
are showing Strange Days.
Oh, they are?
Yeah. They're showing Strange Days. They show Blue Steel, which is what we watched.
Near Dark.
Strange Days. And that first one...
Well, I hadn't heard of, but it looked like I had Willem Dafoe in it.
Yeah. And what's the other one she did?
There is another one.
But she used to be, anyway, she used to be quite the genre filmmaker, right? And I think that all of her films have something of a slant. None of them are generic or cliche. And most of them, I think, sort of play off the sort of cliche stuff, and we can get into that with Blue Steel a little bit. But that was kind of exciting to me because I'm a big fan of cult films, genre films, as you know.
Exploitation
films. But I also like, I've always claimed that B-movies, horror movies, genre films, call them what you like, have for the longest time given women especially far more diversity in their roles, either being producer, director, composer, writer, whatever, but also as actors have given them far more diversity. And I actually think that genre films show, while there are obviously exploitative elements in them that some may claim exploit women, I think that they also are a breeding ground for actually strong female characters in a way that a straightforward Hollywood hasn't been in the same way. And I've always said that. So I was kind of excited they were doing this series. Unfortunately, the only one that... Well, not unfortunately, but the one that fitted into our time slot was Blue Steel.
Is this movie after she broke up with Cameron?
No.
Interesting.
Because Cameron co-wrote Strange Days, which is after this movie. I mean, unless he co-wrote it and then... I don't know when they broke up, but I don't know about them at all. Jim is referring to people who don't know that the director, Catherine Bigelow, was married to the director, James Cameron.
For a while.
For a while. I think past True Lies, though. I think they were still together while he made True Lies.
Really?
I've got a feeling that... if not, I would imagine that Curtis...
Point Break?
Yes, that's the other one she does. Point Break, that's the other one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wow, that's great.
Wonderful, thank you.
This is really terrific.
You're right, Point Break is the one. So she's known for Point Break, Strange Days.
These chips are amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah. And they're only oven chips, but... They're really good.
Oh, K-19 The Widowmaker was the other one. I haven't seen that. She directed three episodes of Homicide, Life on the Street.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I could see how that would work.
So this was her next movie after Near Dark. The Loveless was her first movie.
Russia did a play one, yeah.
So this was her third film. And after this, she does Point Break, which is sort of interesting because... Point Break is all males, right? But yeah. It's known for its sort of... I don't know that it's the introduction of it, but it certainly plays up the whole homoeroticism between the male leads kind of thing, right?
I mean, I never got that vibe when I was watching it, but maybe if I went back, I might get that.
I mean, that's what it's sort of jokingly...
I'm just saying, there was a lot going on in Blue Steel... that had I watched it when I was 14, I would definitely have gone way over my head. Possibly because it was 1989, it would have gone way over my head.
Right. So, Blue Steel then, let's get to...
Blue Steel. Should people watch it?
Should people watch it? It's a difficult one.
Yes, it is.
And I'll tell you why. It's because Blue Steel, maybe rightly or wrongly, is set up as a late 80s action movie...
In its
poster, in its name, right. In its design. I'm not saying that the story is. I'm saying that it is set up.
Yeah.
If I guarantee the trailer features Jamie Lee Curtis running about with a gun. I guarantee it. At the time, as people know, because we've covered them before on the show, but also Doctor Action, the 80s and certainly the 90s were awash with... machismo and action, and it's the era of Stallone and Arnie and all the rest of it. Moving into the sort of Seagal and Van Damme era in the 90s. And I think really the only other kind of female action that isn't Cynthia Rothrock, which is sort of straight-to-video stuff, is really Sigourney Weaver in the Alien franchise. And, of course... by her husband James Cameron in the Terminator franchise. You have Linda Hamilton. And so there's certainly that vibe, and it's interesting to see that obviously Cameron in both Aliens 2, which is the more action heavy of the franchise, and Terminator sort of puts a woman front and center in the action. Catherine Bigelow is obviously a very strong woman in her presence from everything I've sort of read or know about her. And Blue Steel, if anything, the main through line of Blue Steel is that Jamie Lee Curtis's character is never a victim despite having horrible stuff happen. She never allows herself to become a victim. That's kind of the overriding... If you're going to look for sort of a quote-unquote feminist statement in the movie, that's the statement.
Actually, I think the whole movie is like one feminist statement after another. Like, I don't think you're wrong, but I think you're right. I think that is the basic through line. But the whole thing is... I mean, actually, I've got...
I mean, to some extent, but there's some elements that if you didn't realise the fact... Like, if you watched it through very kind of generic male eyes... You could look at it as the fact that Curtis's character makes a bunch of mistakes, you know, can be a bit stupid at times, is
you know, aware of her sexuality. Like, both the guys in the movie, you know, she is a strongly sexual protagonist with. And if you looked at it through very generic male eyes, without realizing that the through line is that she's never a victim, she's always the protagonist, then you could dismiss the movie as being, you know, about a stupid rookie who sleeps with everyone and gets into trouble.
But what's really going on?
I'm not looking at it that way, I'm just saying.
No, that's, I agree with you, but actually what's happening is, and that's what's interesting about it, to answer the question, should people watch it? It's interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting movie, but I didn't particularly enjoy it.
Yeah, it's not compelling, as it could be.
I think it's one of those films that... But here's the thing. So this is what gets me about the movie. The reason it's not compelling, I think, is it lacks pace. Right? It lacks, snappy dialogue. And it lacks a lot of the... So here's my thing. It lacks a lot of those tropes of an action movie that help to keep the pace up and keep you in that mood. It was only right at the very end, or near the very end, that I realised that actually, in terms of tone and pacing, it's much more of a horror film.
Yeah,
really.
It is.
Because the two biggest moments in the film are scares, like when she finds Ron Silver in a...
We haven't been into the plot, you're right.
But
it's not quite a psychological thriller, but it's a thriller horror.
It's psychological thriller is probably the best. Like in terms of like in the way that Silence of the Lambs is not a horror; it's a psychological thriller. It's correct, like that kind of thing. But
and it's problematic because it's set up.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think it's was
set up as
that.
as an action movie, and it has all the cliches of an action movie without having any of the action.
Right.
Until the very end.
But a lot of things that happen.
But also, the other frustrating thing about it is that for it to be completely successful in its mission, it would have to be just a little bit more, and we'll get into this with the plot, but it would have to be just a little bit more not riddled with holes. It's kind of riddled with holes. But we'll get into that with the plot. Anyway.
That's fair enough. But no, just before we get into the plot, the one thing I would say about it is that what I noticed was a lot of it was about a feminine perspective. In other words, she didn't do anything wrong in the supermarket, right?
Right.
In other words, it's not that she does anything wrong throughout the film, it's just that nobody believes her. And there's a constant thing.
She handcuffs her partner to the car.
Yeah, but that was a conceit that doesn't work, but equally, from her point of view, with everything she'd been up to at that point, I think what that was saying was supposed to be not wanting a man's help just to sort her problems out, I think. And I think that what you're talking about, the holes, are where the...
Well, let's get into the plot first before we go into that.
Right. But what I'm saying is, I don't know this, right, because we haven't gone through every one of your holes, but that hole in particular, I think there are times, and again, I think that's where it falls down for me as well, there are times when what might realistically be expected to happen is sidelined in favour of making a point about something. You know what I mean? And that happened too much for me to really enjoy the film. Like, the lead detective is called Nick Mann.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of the level. And it's not that it's, like, you've got to put your, like, 1989 head on when would need to be beaten over the head. But, like, her in the supermarket when she's, like, first a cop, the dramatic bit where she's thinking about going around the corner and confronting the crook, she's in front of a big display of washing up glass.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. It's all, like, it's making a point, and it's an interesting point, kind of. Again, it's one of those things, it's a bit like Citizen Kane for me. Like, you, not that it's that good. I'm just saying, you go back to this, okay, you're thinking, this isn't as powerful for me watching it now. It could never be as powerful now as watching it back then, because so much of the conventions and the storytelling and the points that it's making are now just like a part of, like, filmmaking and canon.
But I would almost argue that
And all the points it's...
We can have a larger conversation about sort of feminism in cinema right now, and I don't think it's where it needs to be, and I think that this is a... There are elements of this movie that could have been interesting and groundbreaking, but I think that it's...
I'm not saying it's groundbreaking at all. I'm saying that a lot of people are trying to.
It's very difficult to sort of really talk about this film, unfortunately. But should people see it? I think that yes, they should see it, but they should be aware that it is in no way an action movie. Like, action does not break out every 10 minutes. It's not like that at all, and it's certainly not. It's certainly not Catherine Bigelow trying to say, well, women can do it as good as the men can do it. It's not that.
I don't think it is that.
I know. I'm saying it's not that.
All right, okay, fair enough.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's set up like that. Right? In any other movie, this would be Mel Gibson or whoever, and he would start off as a rookie and then get, like, through circumstances, kicked up to detective within a day. And then he'd be tearing around the city, you know, giving up people's Miranda rights and shooting them in the face.
Right.
Right. Which is not what she does.
Right.
Her strength comes from a completely different place.
Right.
And it depends what side of the fence you fall, whether you think it's more empowering someone like, for example, Cynthia Rothrock, Pam Grier, someone like that, who is every bit as... physically active and action orientated as a male protagonist would be.
Right.
Or whether you think that the examination of a woman's inner strength and her ability to there's no other word for it, like to be abused either psychologically or physically and still get up and go through the world. Which is kind of what this movie is saying. But it's saying it with a whole bunch of genre tropes, which I'm not 100% sure are fully understood. But anyway, I would suggest you watch it once, but it's not necessarily required viewing. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think if you're a lady person, I think it would. If you're a lady person, that you would get a lot more out of it than I ever possibly could, because I really think it's trying to speak to the experience of being a woman in the world. And what frustrated me about it, and what made it, you know, sometimes you're watching something, you think, I know this is good, but it's not my cup of tea, it's not my bag. And this is that movie, because all the things it's saying were just a bit too on the nose and a bit too sledgehammery. But in 1989, given the point that it's making, would that not be necessary? The things like, he's called Nick Mann, right?
Right.
And there's things like, she's trying to, in order to survive in a world where she is, from her own witnessing of what happens between her dad and her mum, right, in order to survive that world, she becomes a cop. In other words, I think it's more about trying to appropriate male culture, guns, uniforms, all that, in order to be stronger, in order to survive, right? And how this guy literally takes away her, or tries to get her power, like a bit of her power, a bit of her strength, like takes it away from her,
right,
and uses it to commit senseless violence and gets off on the senseless violence in a way where she's trying to not control the world, but make herself safer in that world of senseless violence. And everything that happens in the movie, all the obstacles she has to overcome, she doesn't have to overcome traditional obstacles, right? Like, you know, your Mel Gibson protagonist. She has to overcome the fact that no one believes her. She's surrounded by men, none of whom believe her. That at the moment when, like, the guy confesses to her, but then his lawyer turns up, And essentially says, what does she know? Some rookie cop, I'll have her badge, she knows nothing. Nobody takes her seriously. Nobody says, look, a police officer...
Right. Again,
this
you're
guy.
Talking about the movie before we've gone through the
no,
plot.
No, but to be... Yes, OK, yeah, fair point. Do you want to do one of your plots?
Because that was also frustrating, that sequence where the lawyer showed up, because of one of the massive plot holes. Anyway...
No, I agree, but again.
I understand, it's not the point. So, plot very briefly in a nutshell.
got him.
Jamie Lee Curtis is
new cop.
The new cop, rookie on the force. The daughter of a put upon and beaten mother and an aggressive alcoholic, possibly father. You see her graduate. And you see her first day on the force, and while she's out, a supermarket gets robbed by
Tom Sizemore.
By Tom Sizemore, playing the character Woolcap, because that's what he's wearing.
Yeah.
She sneaks in round the back, taps his ass to the point where he flies through a window in a particularly, I thought, James Glickenhouse way.
Yeah, it was Glickenhousey.
It was incredibly Glickenhousey. The way that apparently a bullet can raise a fully grown man up on into midair and through a window. But suffice to say, she's involved in a massively horrible and public shooting. Ron Silver...
You want to know why?
Oh, yeah, tell me why.
Because, and this is why I'm interested to know about their relationship, he looks quite a lot like James Cameron.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah. He's got the same... He's shorter, but he's got the same... He's got the same, like...
I don't know that that's why she hired him.
No, I'm just... But you, okay, come on. He is... In the movie, Ron Silver is supposed to be the epitome of masculine aggression, senselessness, but also impotence.
I don't know enough about.
No, I don't either. I'm just saying.
Cameron or Bigelow, and I don't know about their relationship. And all I know is that, you know, they were together and now they're not. I don't know any other information about that.
Well, if I were James Cameron and I was married to her, and then I saw that movie, I'd be worried. He looks quite a lot like James Cameron.
Well, okay, I mean, that, I don't know. I mean, he also looks a bit like Gene Simmons. I mean,
no, he doesn't.
Yeah, he does. In the movie Not Too Young to Die or Never Too Young to Die, Gene Simmons has to put on a beard and wig. He plays like a transsexual mass murderer, but like he has to put on a beard and wig to pretend to be someone else, and he looks exactly like Ron Silver in this movie. Also, in the movie Wanted Dead or Alive with Rutger Hauer, he has a little beard. Gene Simmons has a beard and slightly shorter hair and looks just like Ron Silver. So, I mean, anyway.
Right, but she wasn't married to Gene Simmons.
No, okay, look, I'm not going down some road of he's a Cameron substitute. I've no idea whether that's true or not.
Yeah, but I'm not saying it's true or not. I'm just saying it's interesting.
I mean,
that in a movie about senseless male aggression, the impotent lead that she would choose to cast looks a lot like her husband, that's all. Like, it's a deliberate choice. Like, he's not a tall guy, he's not an imposing guy, he's not a scary guy. He's a. Anyway, you're right, I'm getting ahead. I've derailed your plot summary.
Yeah, but that's arguing like Linda Hamilton, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Sigourney Weaver are all Kathryn Bigelow substitutes in James Cameron movies. I mean, there's no real. Anyway.
No, look, hang on a minute. Wait a minute. Before we get into that, just dismissing what I'm saying as totally worthless, I don't think it's completely without interest that in a film about a woman trying to survive in a man's world where she's tormented, right, by an impotent, violent, senseless, money-grubbing fool, that the guy she chooses to cast in that role looks a lot like her husband. That's it. I'm just saying that's interesting. Maybe she wasn't even aware of it.
I don't know.
I'm just saying it's interesting.
I'm saying, with the best will in the world and all due respect,
yeah,
I don't think
less respect.
I don't think he particularly looks like James Cameron.
You don't think?
No, I don't think.
All right.
Did James Cameron have black hair and?
So is Ron Silver?
No, I said James Cameron didn't have black hair, did he?
Oh, I don't know, but it's the face and the beard and the whole look of it.
I don't think anyone looks like Ron Silver in this movie, but that's by the by. So anyway, in the supermarket, when she has the shootout, there's a guy on the floor, Ron Silver, with his beard. The bad guy, Tom Sizemore's gun, falls in front of him, and he sneaks it under his coat. Cut to Jamie Lee Curtis being reamed out and meeting Nick Mann, played by the awesome Clancy Brown, with ridiculous curly hair. Meanwhile, Ron Silver etches Jamie Lee Curtis's character's name into some bullets and goes on a random murder spree. He hears voices in his head, he smears prostitute blood all over himself, he does a lot of weightlifting and exercise. He's a little bit crazy, let's say. And meanwhile, Jamie Lee Curtis is suspended because they can't find the weapon that Tom Sizemore was meant to be pointing at her, so they can't confirm why she shot him. And so she's suspended, but then when her name starts showing up on bullets, she is then unsuspended and, in fact, promoted to the role of detective to work alongside Clancy Brown in order to both keep her safe but also hopefully smoke out Ron Silver and his beard. That's about it, right? Without any diversions or...
Well, no, you missed that's out. The setup. You missed out that they were going out.
Oh, Ron Silver. Right. Sorry, yes. So, this was a big problem for me. But anyway, Ron Silver, the day she gets suspended, is outside the police station, puts her in a cab because there's torrential rain, and they go have dinner, and then they start seeing each other, and they go on a few dates. And it's not till the third or fourth date that he starts to get weird with her, reveals his true nature.
Which, to be fair, happens real fast. Like,
right.
The first time he does something really weird, he totally reveals himself within about 30 seconds. Like,
right.
It's not like
but this. That's because he, in his mindset, believes, because he witnessed her shoot a guy down, he thinks that she's going to be the Bonnie to his Clyde or the Clyde to his Bonnie, whichever way you want to look at it, and go on a murder spree with him because they're both sort of drawn to the power of the pistol kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when she says, no, you're crazy, I'm arresting you, he then decides to stalk her and shoot her friend, show up at her parents' house, generally just be menacing and awful.
Yeah, more like a kind of a slasher.
Right, and in fact, what I was going to say earlier when you said this was more of a horror than it was an action film, her role is very similar to that of Laurie Strode. Certainly is.
It may not be a coincidence that that's why
she was hired. Right. In the sense that everyone looks at Halloween as very conservative. They look at it as the ones who are frivolous get killed and the one who is a virginal swat, what's the American equivalent, bookworm, is the one that survives. But actually, you can also look at Halloween as the fact that despite being victimized, Laurie Strode is never herself a victim. She's always standing strong against the things that the world is throwing at her, right up until age 20, where everything in her life is going wrong. She can't control her son. She's not doing well in a relationship. She's an alcoholic, blah, 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 blah. But when Michael Myers raises his ugly head, she knows exactly what to do, and she knows how to pick up an axe and go chop the motherfucker's head off. So there is a big comparison between Meghan Turner and Laurie Strode, except that I think that with Meghan Turner, she's already made that journey because of the abuse that she's seen her mother get from her father, maybe even she's had from her father on times. When we first meet her, she's already that a woman with strength.
Yeah, that's pretty fair.
And even though she has completed the same training course as everyone else, in the cops, she's not regarded as anything because she's a woman. Except by her original partner. He likes her when they're driving along in the car. He likes her when they're talking originally. He's like, why did you always want to be a cop? And she says, because I always want to shoot people in the face or make some jokey comment. And he laughs. He's like, I like you, Turner.
Yeah, well, yeah, at that point, I think she's one of the guys, right? That's what's going on there.
Right.
Well, it doesn't take much to be... I guess the point there is... It doesn't take much to be accepted.
Right.
She doesn't... The point of the movie, I think, is not supposed to be... It would be easy to go down the road of, you know, like a prime suspect kind of, like, nobody wants her around.
Right.
Everybody hates her. Because that would be... That's a different movie. This one's more... Less to do with trying to break into the force.
Right.
And more
trying to survive as a woman, trying to trying to be believed, trying to talk to people, trying to.
I think one of the best
make
scenes,
people
although,
understand what happened to you.
Although maybe it's on the nose, one of the scenes that I do actually think work is when she's round her best friends for a barbecue, and her best friend, like in all movies, is trying to set her up with someone, so it becomes this like rom-com scene, like, oh, go talk to Jeff over there, whatever. And Jeff has a cheesy line, and she plays along with it, and da-da-da-da-da. But the moment she admits she's a cop, he's thrown by
that. Yeah, in that scene, the thing, like, the most revealing line, I think, is when he says, you're a beautiful woman, why would you want to be a cop?
Right.
You know, in other words, oh, right, the only reason a woman would be a cop is if she was ugly or, like, looked like a man.
Right.
And that's, in other words, she's got no right to be there.
Right.
You know, like, you'd have to be
and I think,
in the head to want to do that.
And I think even to this day...
Because presumably, if you're a beautiful woman, what he's saying is, why, given that you're beautiful, why aren't you just, like, married to a successful man and then you wouldn't have to do anything?
Like... For example, even today, in the so-called more understanding, more liberal, more diverse world, it's still a piece of shit to be a female director in Hollywood. It's still like...
Yeah, but even more than that, with all this stuff that's been going on, you know, in the news at the moment, like that scene at the end, like that's what he's been doing the whole time. Like,
right.
It only just occurred to me, with like writing her name on a bullet and then shooting into people, he's just... It's his way of fucking her over and over again. Like literally, figuratively, metaphorically, like everything you could imagine. Like he's fucking her because he's like, it becomes a point where he's deliberately fucking up her career.
Right.
You know, he's going out of his way to make her look like a liar and to weaken her. Right. Weaken her in the eyes of her colleagues, weaken her in the eyes of like the men, of the justice system, everybody. He's going out of his way to weaken her. And that bit at the end is really disturbing when he dumps on her after she's.
She's had sex with Clancy Brown.
Who...
Which is, to be honest, a little forced.
It is, but I think, again...
There is a relationship there, and you understand how it might happen.
But again, that's when the movie falls down for me, is there's moments exactly like that. I see why it happened, because she wants Silver to rape her at the end. That's what he wants. She wants to happen. And she feels that there's more power in that, and presumably it leads from somewhere with a bit more realism. If it comes after a natural sex, drawing a parallel between consent and non-consent,
A natural sex scene which Lee Curtis initiates as much as Brown. You're right. I mean
It's just that, but you're right in that happens too much. There's too many times when decisions get made, like what you were talking about with the lawyer, right?
My big problem with the plot very quickly is that she's involved in the shooting in the supermarket, right?
Yes, right.
Whether she does it, her partner who we see run up does it, or whether the police who, if it's New York City, show up in 30 seconds because they're on every fucking corner anyway,
right?
Do it. That scene is locked down, right, and witnesses' statements are taken. There's no bit where Ron Silver is, like, sneaking out the back of the
thing.
That's
the point, I think.
Later on in the movie, there is one throwaway line where she's like, he must have left the scene, right? But all this happens too much in that you see a scene set up, the scene takes place, but the wrap-up of the scene doesn't happen. It jump cuts to something else. And... it does it so that it can conveniently later on just go, oh, he must have walked away from the scene without any kind of real explanation. So it allows them to have the somewhat hokey serial killer stalker trope of him being able to, like, wine and dine her without her knowing who he is. But if she was involved in the case and the shooting of the thing, are you telling me she saw no photographs from that crime scene? She saw no photographs of the witnesses? Like, she didn't... Like, there was none of that. And I'm not saying that it needs to be police procedural accurate, but it's a huge stretch that she shoots someone and that's it. And then she just gets taken away from the crime scene, and nobody, like, she's not involved with anything else.
I agree with you, although I would argue that, you know, the ridiculous Tom Sizemore through the window thing?
Right.
There's a bit after that happens where they all gather by the window.
Right.
Because it is, you know, it's spectacular.
Right.
And they are all drawn to it, all of them. Turn, look at the window. And presumably what happens at that point is he stands up and walks out the back the same way that she came in. Now, listen.
I guess, but listen,
I agree with you. But we're in total agreement here in that the reason that she does all these things is because she's interested in doing is using these tropes to make a point.
Right.
And having them make sense is of secondary importance to her.
I agree with you.
And
it's the one place where I think the film falls back.
Yeah, I agree with you. Because it doesn't... And the reason is, it doesn't move fast enough. Because there are enough points that something happens that's shocking enough or interesting or exciting enough to make you forget, you know, whatever it is that's been bugging you about the movie. But because of, like, the slowness of it, you've still spent 10 minutes being bugged by it.
And it's where...
So you can't really enjoy it.
It's where Silence of the Lambs is a bit more successful, because while Silence of the Lambs is utterly hokey, and it is utterly hokey and makes massive flights of fancy in that movie...
Yeah.
The genre that it's set in keeps it going, like, whether it's detective bits, whether it's action bits, whether it's horror whatever.
They have the advantage of essentially having three main characters. They have her, they have Hopkins, and they have the killer. So there's three different geographies for them to explore. So in other words, they can keep the pace up by just jumping to the next thing. But this one is all about Lee Curtis, and you don't, or rarely, jump to whatever Silver's doing. You do occasionally, but it's slow because it wants you to think. Like, it's one of those movies that it wants you to think about what you're seeing. It wants you to think about what's going on.
Right.
But it's not fast enough to make you forget the way you're being asked to suspend your disbelief.
And I think,
like you're saying, what is supposed to be a genre film.
Right, exactly. And when the attorney shows up, and I don't have so much of a problem of the attorney getting his client off, because he's right, there is no evidence. But then for her chief to be like, no, we leave this guy well alone, it's like, no, you don't. The only suspect you have, this guy. And no, you can't, like, break into his apartment or whatever, but you can, like, stake him out or trail him out or... You know, whatever.
But again, it's.
You certainly wouldn't have a chief be like, "No, leave this guy well alone." And then the moment he shows up at your parents' house, I'm sorry, like, he shows up at a parents' house the same day that he claims that she broke into his apartment and pointed a gun at him and all the rest of it. Like, that sequence where her and Clancy Brown show up. His door's open, by the way, so they have every right to go in because they don't need a warrant if the door's open.
Right.
But they go in, he sat mysteriously in the shadows, she puts a gun up against his head, and when the lawyer shows up, she says, like, I'll see him dead in the ground, or I'm going to shoot your client, or whatever the fuck she says. Which, again, is a really reckless, stupid thing to say. But anyway, it's part of the trope, so we'll move on. But that's the same day that later he shows up at her parents' house. The moment he does that,
it's the same day. It's not, because he says to her, "Take the day." When they're driving back in the car, Clancy Brown says, "Take the day off tomorrow. I'll get the department to lend you a car." And the next thing you see is her driving in a car to her parents' place. It doesn't happen that night. It happens the next day. I mean, it's clumsy because most of the movie takes place at night. But again,
okay. Even if it happens the next day,
yeah.
That's still an admission of guilt on his part. Like, what's his lawyer going to say? Oh, he just showed up at her parents' house? Like...
Yeah, but again, that's where it's turning into a... That's when it starts... She's interested in it being a horror film.
But what I'm saying is that the last whole bit is all about...
Yeah,
we've got to witness him getting the gun, because once we have the gun, we can tie him to the murder and the thing that... Right?
Well, it starts making sense quite quickly, as you have pointed out. But it's, you know, it's making points instead. And my problem is that...
When
those points are obvious, when you don't have to work for them, right? I think this is my big problem with the film. I don't mind films that are slow and where nothing happens, but there's something going on. Because I feel like if it's slow, I'm being given time to
like, figure out what's going on. I can come to my own conclusions. But if somebody's being really, really slow and then making really heavy-handed points all the time about what you're seeing, I'm not sure the points were so heavy-handed. I feel like... No, okay, but heavy-handed is maybe the wrong... Okay. Without possibility of interpretation, they're just there.
I think... The points are fine.
No, I'm not arguing that. No, wait, I'm not arguing that.
I know, I'm saying...
How come I can't... Wait.
All right.
No, I'm just saying, it's not that, that she's got anything wrong with the points that she's making. I'm saying I personally find it difficult to enjoy a film where I'm not being made to work for it, where there's no possibility of interpretation, or it doesn't feel like I earned it or I got it. You know what I mean? Or that I'm in with the filmmaker. It feels like the filmmaker's like sitting and just lecturing me,
right,
talking to me, and I'm just supposed to sit there. I'm not involved in the process. And that leaves me a little bit cold. And not that I think it's wrong. I think it's really interesting. And I definitely would like to have seen it with like 1989 eyes. But that's why I'm just saying that's why I think one of the reasons like I couldn't really enjoy it. Because of that feeling of just being talked at rather than involved in a story and and in the unfolding of that story,
much like I feel in the podcast. No.
What do you mean? All right, but like I'm learning things and coming to understand things while the story is going on, rather than a story just being used, as you're saying, as a vehicle for telling me something. Where in moments where the story doesn't make sense, the point that I'm making is given precedent over sense because of what they're trying to say.
I agree.
Hello one, hello all, and I do hope you're enjoying this episode of the After Movie Diner as much as we were doing it. I just want to interrupt for a memento just to let you know we're doing a complete redesign and relaunch of aftermoviediner.com, and it does not come cheap, but it will be absolutely fantastic to look at and use once it is up. So please, if you wish to support the After Movie Diner and aftermoviediner.com, also to support obviously our weekly podcast costs and cinema costs and diner costs and so on, there are many ways that you can do it. One of the best ways is to go over to patreon.com/aftermoviediner. That's patreon.com/aftermoviediner and sponsor the show. Every time we release a podcast, then you donate simply as little as a dollar. It's a fantastic service. And also, if you donate more than a dollar per show, there are gifts and prizes to be got. So go over to patreon.com/aftermoviediner and sponsor the show today. You'll also be sponsoring the relaunch of aftermoviediner.com. Equally, you can go to aftermoviediner.com and hit the donate button. Hit the donate button and send us cash straight away via PayPal. That's a fantastic way to sponsor the show. Or go over to miskplumbingfixtures.bandcamp.com. That's MISC plumbingfixtures.bandcamp.com and buy one of our many albums housed there within. All that money will be funneled over to the big relaunch of aftermoviediner.com. Equally, if you don't have any cash on you, and I completely and utterly understand that, you can always just go rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, in fact, wherever the podcast is found. Rate it, review it, like it, share it, comment on it, do all the good things, tell all your social media friends about it, tell all your real friends about it, tell everyone about it, even someone you meet in the street. Hit them in the face and say, listen, why don't you go over to aftermoviediner.com and see all the news, reviews, podcasts, interviews, all the cool stuff that we have over there. Why don't you do that? That would be spanking. There will be more ways in the future to support and sponsor the After Movie Diner. But for now, let's go back to the diner and hear more about Blue Steel.
I don't have a problem with them making points, but I wish that... What ends up for me, taking away the fact that this is directed by a woman or stars a woman, if you were just watching this movie, for me, the big problem is, if you don't have... The reason why something like Lethal Weapon or Die Hard or Rambo, any of them, work in terms of a genre film, Lethal Weapon is the best example, is that... It has all the tropes. They were tropes even then. They were tropes in the 60s and 70s, shouty chief at the two wisecracking detectives or whatever, right? The reason they work is they allow you to suspend disbelief, right? So they allow you to, well, we're all along for the ride, so the fact that there is a shouty chief going, Riggs, murder, you cost the city millions, blah, 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 right? And then in they bumble with Mel Gibson doing his, like, Three Stooges stick and Danny Glover being like, I'm too old for this shit. The reason why that all works is it, you know, or like Eddie Murphy in Beverly Hills Cop, wisecracking everything wrong. You're just, it's that cushion of air between reality and this heightened reality that allows you to float along nicely with all the other bullshit that goes on, right? The problem with this movie, and I'm looking at what exactly what you're saying and agreeing with you, but from the other way. The problem with this movie is all the cliches and tropes, such as shouty chiefs, such as attorneys who show up who are like, I'm going to have your badge and blah, 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 blah. Even down to fucking Silver stripping naked and running blood all over him. They become... And there were actually even people in the cinema laughing. Three women who were sat behind us. But they become laughable because the rest of it is, like you say, either making a point or trying to ground itself in some form of reality for women. So in other words, it's trying to speak to women about the reality of their lives, whatever job they're in, and whatever they come across, whether it's men they have to date or men who abuse them or whatever it is. And I think that that's the problem. Whereas, like, I think Silence of the Lambs is a very good comparison. You never feel, even at its most ludicrous, when Hopkins is wearing someone else's face, or, you know, people are, they go to a psychiatric ward and it's all like a medieval jail cell with people hissing and swearing and throwing cum about, whatever it is. Like, even if in its most ridiculous, you are buoyed by the fact you're like, oh, I'm in a movie. And you've suspended disbelief because all the right tropes are there. And I think the problem is this movie neither deconstructs the tropes that it's talking about. So it doesn't say, okay, here's a female protagonist, let's see the difference that if we have a shouty chief with a female protagonist, let's flip that on its ass and have the woman, like, whatever, be the hero of that moment, or however you want to deconstruct the trope. It doesn't do that. It has the trope merely as a function of going, this is a Hollywood movie, but while you're watching a Hollywood movie, we're going to whip this, like, stuff at you, important message and stuff like that. And it isn't as successful, although I have no problem with any of the messages in it or the character that Jamie Lee Curtis plays, which I actually think is a really great character for her, and I think she does a really good job. I have no problem with any of that. I have a problem from a pure filmic term is that all the ludicrous tropes stand out. They just stand out like a sore thumb. You just suddenly you're in the middle of a shouty cop scene and you're like, this is stupid.
Yeah, that's fair.
This is stupid. Like the Jenkins pacing back and forth with his hand on his hip and the little fucking smoking dude with the slick back.
Yeah, you're right. It
just looked all stupid.
You're right, it doesn't work. I think the point of it, or what they were maybe trying to go for, was A, to give them cover for making the film.
Yeah, of course.
We're making genre. But also partly like, well, how does a woman survive in these genre situations?
Right.
But you're right, it doesn't really work because the point being made is, well, if you're a woman, you're not listened to. But of course the problem is that,
well, she survives by ludicrous leaps of logic. Like, let's make her a detective and let's make her Clancy Brown's partner and let's make her run... Like,
No, I agree, but what I'm saying is the difference... If... What you're saying with, like, Riggs and Myrtle, right? With Lethal Weapon. When the chief doesn't believe that, it's because they don't have evidence or, like, they're trouble or he's been chewed out by the mayor or whatever. There's 100 reasons why they're not believed, right? And the message that's... In this movie, it's supposed to be, it's like, well, she's not believed, they don't take her seriously because she's a woman. And it's supposed to be using this genre as a mirror for what women's life is like, right? Hey, being a woman is like being a detective in a cop film where the chief won't listen to you even though you know you're right because you don't have the evidence, you know what I mean, in the argument or whatever.
And that's what it's like. But you're right, it just plays out like a straight-ahead genre scene, which sticks out in the movie that you're watching.
Yeah.
You don't come away with that message necessarily, because what a female detective being yelled at by her chief for going over the line, for not having any evidence, and she's off the case, give me a gun and badge, looks exactly the same as the
right.
male detective
right.
with the same thing happening to him.
Right.
And that's the genre trope, just by changing sex, but nothing else is different.
Right.
So you're right, it just stands out. That's,
and
that's
also, I'm also coming from a place, like I said before, I'm coming from a place where you would get that scene in a Cynthia Rothrock movie, and she would be like, shut the fuck up, chief, blah, 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 whatever
see,
it is.
Again,
and then she would go out and kung fu fight villains and blah 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 blah, but you would be dragged along by it because you're like, I'm in a Cynthia Rothrock movie, she's going to win at the end.
Yeah,
blah,
but
blah,
I, suppose
blah, blah,
the,
blah.
I suppose the thing is though, two things. One, that she's not making a film that's supposed to inspire, it's supposed to reflect. In other words, you don't have Jamie Lee Curtis like yelling back at her boss or like doing what, you know, women wish they would do when men, you know, treadle over them. It's supposed to reflect what it's like.
No, of course. No, I get that.
But equally, there are moments, like, you know, you were talking about like the women laughing. There was a moment when they laughed in the movie that I felt was genuine joy and engaging with the film, which was when she's in the hospital and she asked the cop for a cigarette, and the cop's all like, yeah, you've been through quite a lot, like kind of slightly patronising male cop attitude to her, and she slugs him in the face
right.
and knocks him out. And they got, the women behind us got a huge kick out of that.
Right.
They really, really liked
well,
that.
Well, so did I. I enjoyed it. I just didn't woo.
Yeah. But they did. And I felt, because it felt like in their response, that spoke to something deep inside of them.
Right.
Because it's not like the guy didn't, like, he wasn't mean. He was a slightly patronising offer of help to the woman. And when the woman knocks his, you know, block off, they really, really liked that, which I think speaks to some experience that we can't ever hope to tap into.
Right, except that. I agree. The whole point of that last sequence, post her slugging the guy, is that, if you read it just as a movie, is that he will always find her. He's coming after her. And the only person who can lure him out of hiding, Ron Silver out of hiding, and have a showdown with, is her. Nobody else can do it. So her sitting in hospital isn't going to help anybody. No police on the beat, nothing like that. He will eventually find her. And in fact, he does find her. All she does is walk the streets the whole night dressed as a cop. And he does find her, like, on the Wall Street subway. Now, we know he works on Wall Street, but it's not going to work. It's not like... But he does just find her. And then they have like a generic shootout in the end in Wall Street, but in any other movie, whether it was a female or a male protagonist, that point would have been like when she slugged the policeman. We would have known at that point that there was no other option. That there, and I don't think that. The movie, again, I think the movie played that as a feminist moment or a moment of, that, like you say, speaks to something we might not know, rather than, in any other movie where it would be like, you can't go rogue, I have to go rogue, it's the only way that I can, whatever.
Right.
And there would be one other person who knows why Mel Gibson has gone rogue or Axel Foley has gone rogue or whatever. And I think that I think I'm sort of in a roundabout way making the same kind of point, is that you are sacrificing either a plot or a genre for the sake of making a message that I think certainly by that point in the movie is inherent anyway. I think the message you're making at the end of that about her not being a victim and her being the only one and her standing up against her attacker and so on and so forth would be made anyway. And I also think you're right. I think we're watching it with post-1989 eyes. So I'm watching it as someone who watches a lot of female-centric films, whether they're action movies, detective dramas, but
yeah,
whatever
like,
they
it's
are.
Not that's the thing. It's not. So, but remember. Remember, okay, which is not that long ago, but still after, I think, so Prime Suspect, which is early 90s, right?
Right.
So it's three years after this movie.
He's referring to the British not miniseries, is it? British
kind of one-off drama.
Ongoing drama films starring Helen Mirren.
But the whole point of that...
As a DC Tennyson?
DC, yeah. So the point of so we're talking about early 90s here.
Right.
And in that TV show, the point of it... is that this female detective is like all these men's bosses, and they can't handle it, and she's not sure if she can handle it, and her husband can't handle it, and the whole conceit of the show is how weird it is to have a female boss, and this is it's delightful watching it again because it's not only that, but like it's like all the offices, all the London police offices are dingy and grey, and they're all smoking fags, they're all tapping away on typewriters. You think this is only the 90s, but now everything's like everybody's got a female boss, everybody works in a bright, well lit office, they're all computer savvy, nobody smokes, nobody drinks, everybody looks great. You know what I mean? There's no like fat, sweaty, slobby people solving the case anymore. And that's good, but I'm saying it's like. Three or four years after this movie, there's a TV series where the central drama is having a female boss is unacceptable to these men, to these male police officers. They feel more than threatened. They feel emasculated. They feel it's ridiculous, that it's political correctness gone mad. You know, all the things that, you know, still to some extent exist today. And that's 4 years after this movie.
And there's
all the things that this movie is saying
Similar things with... Not quite the whole boss thing, but there's similar comments being made in Homicide with Melissa Leo's character.
Yeah.
And there's similar things being said in Cracker with...
Oh, yeah, the same
Geraldine?
Curly redhead, yeah. Geraldine James. Both curly redheads.
Right.
Something about curly redheads in police dramas, clearly.
You know what I mean? Where they both have to be feminine, but also one of the boys. You know
yeah,
I mean?
which is fine, but that's...
It's a slightly different message, but...
Yeah, but you're right.
There's those characters emerging in the 90s.
But yeah, and in this one, she doesn't even try to be feminine, at least when she's a cop. She doesn't... There's no banter with, like, her, you know, using her wiles or them, like, making sexist comments, because it's not about that. It's not about her in the job. It's about her as a woman in the world. And Silver and the her bosses and her co-workers who don't believe her, and Silver who's threatening her, and it's
I think it's a metaphor more for Bigelow's experience as a female director in Hollywood.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is. Yeah, absolutely. But I think that experience can be extrapolated to any woman that works in any office or any job. You know, they're going
to
find themselves surrounded by men who don't listen, who don't believe them, and presumably, and this is the thing, right? Because we don't even think about it sometimes, but just walking home. At night, it's a terrifying experience for a woman. And like, presumably, getting drunk at a party is like incredibly scary because you think, "Well, I don't want to get too drunk in case something really bad happens to me." And we've got no conception of what that must
be
like.
No, of course
like.
Not. No. You know, I mean, guys, we've got absolutely no conception of most of what the rest of the world goes through.
That's true. But this movie, I think, is supposed to be some attempt to reflect a woman's day-to-day experience through the medium of a cross between a generic cop drama and a horror film. And I think the problem is that if I had to pick holes in the genre of it, that
then I think sequences like Ron Silver talking to himself and then claiming himself to be God and screaming and sweating, and sequences of him rubbing himself in blood, the film would be far more effective if he was just a... All he would have to be would be like a Wall Street creep with a slightly heightened sense of like...
I agree, but again...
murderous impulse. He doesn't have to be a sweaty, crying, screaming madman.
I think
that undermines the message.
I agree. I think it does. But again, I think...
Because it's not a screaming, crying, sweaty madman who's going to be attacking a woman or stalking a woman. It could be...
No, it's not, but it's supposed to be... That's the thing. Like, the reason I think it goes in that direction is, first of all, that's the evolution of his character. In other words, she's saying, at the heart of these men, this is what they are. They are screaming, crying, I want, I want, I want, you know? And the whole talking to God thing, that totally threw me to start with. But then about 5 minutes later, I thought, well, I guess the point being made here is that, you know, the number of times men have done unbelievably hideous things to women, and it's because, well, God told me to. You know, I've been talking to God, and he said it's okay. Like, that's happened many, many times throughout history. And as for, like, covering himself with blood and all that, that's, you know, that whole kind of primitive cave. It's just... it's not that the points aren't well made or well founded. It's just like you're saying, they don't belong in that movie because you're being thrown out of the genre on far too regular a basis, or you're being reminded of like these genre tropes that don't fit with the other things that are happening. It's too much of a mishmash. Just because I was what I was saying about the genres is, I think the problem is it doesn't work as an action film because there aren't, like you're saying, there's not enough action in it.
Right.
And it doesn't work as a horror film because the reason you can have long, slow periods of nothing punctuated by something really extreme in a horror film is that extreme is like really, you know, it's bloody or, you know, it's intense, whatever the hell it is, right? It's intense, either viscerally or orally or physically or whatever. But
it's more water.
Yeah. The reason you're able to get through the slow periods is because you're waiting for the next horrible thing to happen. And the things that happen are action beats, not horror beats. So you're being asked to wait a horror film length of time, and then you're being rewarded with action beats instead of horror. And that's where you're left like continually a bit like, it's a bit stuttery, the whole experience of watching it.
So I think they're all valid points. However, as we've been talking, and as I've been thinking back over it again, there are some incredibly effective scenes.
Yeah, there's lots about it. I liked a lot.
I really liked a lot. I think Jamie Lee Curtis and Clancy Brown are
superb. Yeah, they're very good. It's nice to see him get, like, a lead.
Yes. And he's not quite like the cop with a heart of gold, but he's not like the sexist male protagonist either. Like, he's got a nice balance to him.
He's an odd-looking guy, he's an odd-looking bugger, though. And I'm wondering why... because initially, the first time I saw him, I thought, he looks a bit like Frankenstein's monster crossed with Frankenfurter, what he looked like in that first shot with that ridiculous curly hair, but with like his crazy like Frankenstein monster face. And I don't know, there's something, he's a bit scary, he's very tall, he's a bit scary looking, but he ends up like being somebody that, like, you know, he's the only guy that believes him. So there's something going on there, although I don't quite know what it is, but I definitely think casting him in the lead is, because, you know, he's obviously not your standard Hollywood lead. Maybe she didn't want any light taken off Curtis. She didn't want... do you know what I mean? She didn't want anybody like sharing that limelight. She wanted the focus to be on Curtis and Curtis alone. And he is just... even though it's like, you know, he is technically kind of the male lead, really he's a supporting player.
It's also interesting that, you know, like Curtis's sexuality that would normally be played up, and if you look at something like True Lies, for example, say what you like about Cameron casting leading women, like the thing everyone remembers about True Lies is Jamie Lee Curtis's striptease pole dance, which is, you know, particularly exploitative. None of that is made an issue, and in fact Curtis has no problem I think like the whole second half of the movie she's not wearing a lick of makeup, like in terms of like beauty makeup, and is, you know, and is just as she would be in these situations, and not played up for anything, which I think is good. The sequence with the parents is really unnerving and played really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah, that, the reveal especially, like there was an audible gasp from the audience.
Yeah.
When the cinema, when the mum stood aside and Silver was just sitting.
Yeah.
That was neat.
The cinematography throughout the movie is excellent.
I'll tell you one thing that was good as well was the...
which is funny because the one...
sorry, go on.
The one thing I haven't mentioned is the fact that once she became on the Hollywood radar, and once she started to do The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, whatever, I had no interest. I thought The Hurt Locker could have been directed by anyone, and I thought it was a particularly boring, unengaging story. I was not a fan of that movie at all. And I've not seen K-19 Widowmaker, but I mean, I can't even comment on it.
American actors doing ropey Russian accents is never for me.
Right. I just feel like even in a film like this, which is a fairly recognisable genre, I still say that the genre films are still where the best work is being done. Because once you see her become an Oscar-winning director, I think this film looks 10 times better than The Hurt Locker did. I think that the, in terms of direction, in terms of cinematography, in terms of... There's a little bit of ropey editing. There's a few establishing shots that are pretty but don't actually make a lot of sense in terms of the geography of what's going on. There's a lot of close-up, but that may have been budgetary. It may have been, we can't actually film in New York for this bit. We have to film in a studio, so let's just do close-ups or whatever. But no, I'm more interested in this, and I'm more fascinated in this film than I am any of her later ones. I like this one, Strange Days, Near Dark, and Point Break, although I'm not the fanboy of Point Break that a lot of other people are, but those four, I would say, are prime Bigelow.
But on the other hand, you can see, given that she makes a bunch of successful genre films, like Near Dark was a successful modern retelling of the vampire legend that no one was doing at the time or even thinking about doing. Like, they're all like grimy, southern serial killers is what they are, really. And then Point Break, which is like a huge hit. But you kind of feel like, I don't know, there's a bit about the movie which I'd like to see it again, but it's a bit taking the piss, I think, kind of. But Strange Days was a bit of a flop, I think. I think they thought Strange Days was going to be really, really big, and I think it was a bit of a flop.
It's a brilliant movie, though, and Angela Bassett is amazing.
Yeah, and it's a great, and it is a great film, and I really, really like it. But interesting that Sizemore turns up in that. If I were her, then I'd say, well, I've done the right thing going with the serious Hollywood stuff.
Oh, yeah, no, for her career, of course she has. I just said it ceases to be interesting to me.
No, and that's fine, because, you know, and that's totally cool. But I guess she tried a bunch of different things, and the one thing she had success with was, oh, if I make films about blokes and the hard things they had to do to be blokes as a woman, that seems to, like, people seem to be interested in that. It seems to engage people. It seems to resonate, because that happened with Point Break. So I'll do that again with The Hurt Locker, and I'll do it with, you know, and I haven't seen Zero Dark Thirty, so I don't know how much of it is about that, to be fair.
Well, it's a leading female protagonist, isn't it?
Yeah,
Jessica Chastain in that.
So, yeah, so I don't know. But all anybody talked about was Chris Pratt. But anyway, I don't know. But
Pratt's in that?
You are?
Pratt's in
Yeah, that was his like launch from Zero Dark Thirty.
Oh, we got her to blame for Pratt?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, her or Amy Poehler, I guess.
Oh, no, I like him in Parks and Rec. I just can't stand him as a serious actor. He's awful.
Yeah, I really... Jurassic World is a fucking massive film.
Actually, isn't that also Jessica Chastain?
No, that's
Bryce Dallas Howard, right.
Mr. Ron Howard, you've what's the...
Oh, yeah, the Matt Farley Motor Media song about Mr. Ron Howard, you've got a beautiful
Can
daughter.
Can I go on a date with your daughter?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is that it? Mr. Ron Howard, you've got a lovely daughter. She was great in the village, she was great in the lady in the water. And I was thinking that maybe, just maybe, you oughta grant me permission to go on a date with your daughter. I know that you're familiar with show business and all the no good phonies that you can find in this business. But I'm not like that, I'm a small town guy. I come from a place called Peabody. I appreciate a talented and lovely girl who comes from a respectable family. Mr. Ron Howard, you're a fine director. Your movies always generate a lot of great buzz. And I'm not saying that just because I wanna go out with your daughter, heck, you could even come along. Just don't invite M. Night Shyamalan.
He's already spent too much time with her, if you ask me. Mr. Ron Howard, you've got a lovely daughter. She was great in the village, she was great in the lady in the water. And I was thinking that maybe, just maybe, you oughta grant me permission to go on a date with your daughter.
For great songs like this and much, much more, over 18,000 songs, in fact, go to MotownMedia.com. That's M-O-T-E-R-N Media.com. Or look up Motown Media at Motown Media on Twitter. Or check out the official Motown Media playlist on Spotify.
But it's funny how, like, Bryce Dallas Howard and Jessica Chastain, no offence to either of the women, I'm just like, they could be interchangeable as far as...
They do look quite similar. They do look...
Well, no, but they're also just like, who are they?
There was a thing, sorry, just to get back quickly to Blue Steel, there was a thing with the sound design.
I feel the way about Guys as well. There's, like, you can take your Ryan Goslings and Chris Pratts, and although The Nice Guys was really good, but in general, your male leads are not doing anything for me either. That wasn't a sexist guy. That was just a comment of, like, most people in movies these days are interchangeable with wardrobes. I mean, really.
Yeah, especially the stubbled, curly, black-haired English actors.
Yeah.
Cropping up in fucking everything.
Yeah.
Like, that's what, like, Preacher's supposed to be, you know, oh, watch Preacher on AMC. I'm like, no, because it's got another curly, black-haired English bloke doing an unconvincing American accent. I don't like him either. Dominic Cooper. I don't care.
Yeah.
The number of curly, black-haired English actors with their stubble who are not very good at acting in Game of Thrones is extraordinary. It's got move for them.
Yeah.
None of them can act.
No.
None of them.
No.
And the other thing is, because every now and then in Game of Thrones, like the world's greatest actor just walks into the room and it's amazing, next to this, like, curly, bestubbled git. Like,
yeah.
Well, we've got, I feel for them,
we've
really.
We've got Bendy Dick and Slumbercrotch and Tom Hiddleston. I don't have a funny name for him.
Tom Piddleston.
Yeah.
Tom Piddlestown.
But, like, I saw the first half
Dump
of...
Dump Piddlestown.
I saw the first half of High Rise, which was meant to be, like, a so-achingly clever satirical comment on things. And I'm like, Brazil said all of this in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, but I really like The Kill List.
The Kill List is good for about 45 minutes.
No,
just
like
Side Seekers was really good for 45 minutes.
I couldn't get past, yeah, I couldn't get through all the Side Seekers. No, I really like The Kill List.
Side Seekers? Side Seekers.
No, Side Seekers.
I haven't seen A Field in England, but it doesn't appeal to me. Although I do like Smiley. I could watch Smiley in anything. I'm with John on that one. I will watch Smiley in anything.
Smiley?
He's awesome. He plays Tyres in Space.
Oh,
the Irish
yeah,
dude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
he's
yeah.
in Kill List.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
oh, no, I love
he's going to be
the
in
ending
we-
of Kill List. Like,
he's going to be in Wheatley's new one, but High Rise, I couldn't make it past the first half an hour. I was just like, oh, give me a...
But I think what I like about him is he doesn't really give a shit about what anybody thinks about his movies. He really doesn't give a fuck.
No, as long as he's getting money to keep it. No, but I mean, High Rise will be a huge, like, indie sleeper hit because Hiddleston's all over it with his bum out.
Well, there we go. Well, it doesn't necessarily... Anyway...
What was it? I think it was like $6 to... Anyway, carry on, yeah, finish up on...
No, I was just... One thing that happened in Blue Steel that I never really got necessarily understood was the sound design. There was a lot about the silence and using that... Like, it all happened from, like, title sequence with, like, the close-up of the gun and Brad Fiedel's, like, quiet, weird, kind of otherworldly synthesizer. When they're up in the helicopter, it's happening again, and there's
yeah.
something about... And so much of his life is noise,
yeah.
you know, and her life is like either the rain or the sound of New York or whatever. And there's lots about moments of either like total silence or this like incredible crashing noise
yeah.
of life around them. And I didn't quite know what that was. It didn't seem to necessarily mean anything except... Like, I initially thought it was to do with, oh, his life, he lives in this, like, quiet penthouse, and he wants to get down amongst the noise and the dirt, but when he's in the the trading pit, it's all screaming and shouting and the, you know, the noise he walks through and the traffic. And so it wasn't that. So I didn't know quite what it was, but that was...
There was something to do with loud and quiet. And
but I'm not sure it necessarily was anything, except that...
There was that whole comment about the snow, it's so peaceful and quiet.
Yeah.
There was the whole bit where after the trading floor, he was in the bathroom by himself examining the gun and was having to be quiet.
That's true.
There was a lot.
Maybe it's a horror film thing.
He makes the comment about throw a stick up in the air and it'll either hit
a taxi or an ambulance
because they hear the siren go by. There is something to do with.
I wonder if it's like a horror film thing, like that, you know, how effective sound design is in horror films, like in The Exorcist, for that first half an hour in The Exorcist where nothing happens, everything is either total silence or like huge noise.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, it just goes back and forth between the two.
They don't normally comment on it, though, so it's interesting that it's woven into the dialogue.
Yeah, that's true. But I wonder if it isn't a horror... Because nothing happens in the first, 45 minutes of The Exorcist?
Yeah.
And I remember being really unnerved by the first 45 minutes, and I think a lot of that was to do with the sound design. But you're right, they comment on it, and that's not a usual thing. It doesn't seem necessarily to mean anything except that silence is nice and noise isn't.
Yeah.
Did we need that?
But overall...
It was interesting and it made me think. I'm just not sure I enjoyed it.
Overall, it's very interesting.
That's probably what I would say.
I think that if some effort had been made on the pacing, that would have helped. And I don't quite know what that is. Whether you have an action beat or whether you have something.
I think sometimes you experiment with something and it just doesn't come off.
Right.
And I think that's what
And I
wise.
Think that the other biggest problem in the film for me is the father. While I understand it, the whole sequence where she handcuffs him, drives him out into the middle of nowhere, he apologizes for everything, and then they come back, and suddenly has his arm around the mother and everything.
That felt a bit tacked on. If I'm going to have this... I understand him as an impetus. Yeah,
I understand.
Right, but that's what I mean. I wonder whether she didn't feel like that needed to be addressed at some point. If she's going to have a protagonist who makes choices and does things, she's going to have to do something about the dad. She's going to have to punch him or talk to him.
But you then have the sequence where Ron Silver's shown up to their apartment. That is utterly unrealistic because no one is saying anything. There's clearly something going on, and yet the parents are acting like, oh, isn't it lovely that this random stranger has come into our home, which no one ever would be, certainly not the father, who's known to be an abusive drunk. So that whole thing didn't
the logic of the film set to one side, because I think what's happening there is that feels like a conversation between the secret conversations that had between husbands and wives when the husband beats the wife, you know, like how they can communicate and talk in like a crowded room or at a party when she knows that he hit her the night before and he knows it and maybe he feels like she's stepping out of line, how they can threaten each other and reason with each other even in crowded, like even in dinner parties or parties.
But then there was the whole bit where like the news report comes on and the dad goes, oh, look at that. And then Ron Silver awkwardly has to stand up and be like, can we not watch television? Like, who would... Like,
yeah, no, you're right. To be fair, I think the point you made earlier about how the film is full of scenes that don't wrap up, I think that's a big part of the problem. They don't conclude, they don't wrap up.
But I don't want to go down that hole again. There are some very effective scenes in it. There's some good acting in it. There is some strong writing, but also some weak writing in it. It looks very good, and as you say, it's certainly interesting, and I think it's fueled a good discussion.
I think you could do worse. I think if you are a lady person, I think you could watch it, and I think you probably would get a lot more out of it than we have, and probably be a lot more forgiving.
While I think you're right, we probably won't get just can't get the same out of something like Blue Steel that maybe a female audience would. I think from our discussion, it's certainly one of the most successful movies I've seen that demonstrates a little of what we're talking about, of just how it must be like, and that danger and that difficulty and those challenges.
Yeah, that like constant feeling under threat in the big city, which I imagine they must all the time.
Oh yeah, no, there's a great Louis C.K. bit about like the fact that women still go on dates is amazing to him, because absolutely everything that is bad in the world that has been done to them is because of men. Like, absolutely everything. They don't have any other natural predators. It's all because of men.
Yeah.
So the fact that they get up each morning and still want to spend time with us.
Especially you and me.
Yeah, of course. Well, wait a minute. I've never oppressed anybody. What are you talking about?
Well, I just mean that spending time with us can be...
No, I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about oppressive, violent, horrible men.
Oh, fine. Yeah, but still, like,
no, we're awful, but we're not. we're still awful in a violent,
the women that we're with
way.
Choose to get up in the morning and spend time with us is a triumph of hope over experience.
Yes, but not for the reasons I was talking.
No, I know.
Anyway, good place to end it.
I'm not suggesting that you beat your girlfriend.
No, I know.
Are you going to keep the bit in where I got grumpy?
No.
You're going to get rid of that?
Got grumpy.
I got grumpy. There was a bit where I got grumpy.
Oh, no, I'll keep it in.
You sure? Sorry,
I
got grumpy.
But no, I want, like, I liked what you said, and I agree with that. I think it does very successfully, as much as it can do, show a little bit of the other side. And I think that is very relevant, and I think that is needed, and I think more films should. And I think maybe, Mike, like, if you look at the Buffy, Xena, Cynthia Rothrock, Pam Grier, whatever it is, their triumphs are more obvious to guys, because it's all based on brawn or whatever it is.
Plus, they're all directed by men.
And there isn't that idea of women's strength coming from what they can endure rather than what they can give back.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah, I like that. It's good.
And with that, that's it.
Nice.
Thanks very much, Jim.
Genre films go. There was a time when horror, action and crime seemed your bread and butter. But then serious real life drama scripts and Oscars, your desk, they now clutter. And your genre roots seem such a long time ago. Oh, Catherine, Catherine, Catherine Bigelow. Catherine, Catherine Bigelow, when did you really know that serious, ponderous, desert-based dramas were the way to go? What happened to the madness of near dark and strange days? Or the message-filled psychological thriller of Blue Steel? Oh, and even if we accept that artists can grow and change, why do we care if Jeremy Renner's struggle is real? And will you ever go back to your genre days from long ago? Catherine, Catherine, Catherine Bigelow. My movies, ludicrous and silly, entertaining and bizarre, too, imaginative and inventive, make reality seem stretched pretty far. There is too much reality down here on the ground, up on the screen, give me amazing sights and sounds. Catherine, Catherine Bigelow, I want you to personally know that the moment you come back to us, to your movies, I will go. But while you play around with reality and war, I will personally find it all a bit of a bore. Oh, and that because I like my movies to be movies and news the news. But don't worry, Catherine, I understand. Everyone has the right to choose. So if those are the movies that you want to make, then who am I to say that it gives him the blues? It is hard enough for a woman in Hollywood without idiots like me criticizing you. But my personal taste is for your early work. I hope that doesn't make me a great big jerk. And I wish you every success in this business they call show. Yes, Catherine, Catherine, Catherine Bigelow. You better believe it, yes. I wish you every success, Catherine Bigelow. I know you made Point Break and I didn't sing about that. But I couldn't work it into the song, don't you know? So why don't we just keep singing Catherine Bigelow over and over again, don't you know? Yes, I wish you every success, Catherine Bigelow.